Wondering if you should stay in Illinois or move out of state? Get your copy of Scott Tucker's book, Escape Illinois, Should I Stay or Should I Go? Get your complimentary copy at retirementdakota.com.
Investment advisory services are made available through AE Wealth Management, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
If you have been following the news, in mid-December, Rob Reiner and his wife, Michelle, were found stabbed to death in their Brentwood, California home, and their son, Nick, who was a troubled kid from a troubled past, was charged with first-degree murder. And with us to break down the charges here and what might happen is Damon Chironas. He's one of the best criminal defense lawyers in Chicago, founder of Chironas and Parente. He is an advocate for people charged with federal, white-collar, violent crimes, drug, and sex crimes. He's been involved with some of the high-profile cases, including the Harvey Weinstein case. Welcome to the show, Damon. How are you?
Hey, Karen, how are you doing? Thanks for having me on. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. This case just really hit home with so many people who have troubled children or children with mental illness and drug problems. Let's break this down. Now, Nick Reiner was scheduled to be in court in December for his arraignment, but it was rescheduled to January 7th, which is coming up this week. I heard a lot of pundits on social media talking about why that might have happened. Is that a common thing for an arraignment to be delayed? Isn't it just usual and standard that the defendant will come to court and plead not guilty? Why would there be a delay?
I mean, it happens all the time for a lot of different reasons. I don't think there's necessarily something in a regular case you would read into it. Here, you know, it's quite possible that he is being, you know, looked at by doctors. You know, they're trying to gauge his mental health, if he has any of those issues. But I don't think that it's something that would jump out to me one way or the other in this situation. If it is a mental health issue, which might be the road they're going down, I think they want to get started on that early. And that might be one of the reasons that they are continuing the arraignment.
And I would imagine that if they're going down that road, and we're going to talk about a little bit later, you know, how mental health issues and drug addiction issues affect a criminal prosecution in these kinds of cases. You know, isn't it important to kind of gauge what his mental health is right away? Because the closer that assessment is to when the crime was committed, the better for the defense if there is such a problem and that problem caused him to do what he did. Or at least that's the argument
sure.
That's going to be made.
Yeah, when you have a mental health defense, whether it's insanity or something else, you've got to get to work on it right away. You have to have doctors involved. And again, you know, it's my understanding, and just having read up on this recently for the show, that he had a diagnosis at some point of schizophrenia, which is, for a defense attorney, you know, something that they're going to key in on. It's not just depression. It's not just potentially drug abuse, but it looks like there was, you know, a diagnosis. And I've represented individuals for murder trials who have been diagnosed with schizophrenia, and we've been able to get not guilty by reason of insanity. So I think if they have that actual diagnosis, that's one of the things the defense is going to have to key in on right away.
And I want to get into the weeds a little bit on that issue, and I'm so glad that you have some experience with this because, you know, as you know, as a criminal defense lawyer, it's not easy to lodge an insanity defense, and we're going to talk a little bit about that, at least a successful one. But I want to talk about the charges. My understanding is that he's charged with first-degree murder for these two deaths and with special circumstances. What does the prosecution have to prove these charges?
Sure. Well, in California, there's a number of special circumstances that can be lodged, and that brings it from, you know, first-degree murder with maybe a set sentence to a mandatory life sentence or potentially even the death penalty. In this case, they're going to have to show that the killing was intentional, potentially premeditated, and that the special circumstances existed. In this case, it's my understanding that the special circumstances were just the number of victims in the case. That's at least one of them. When you have multiple deaths, you know, that can add to the special circumstances, or that can be a special circumstance. You know, something that's extremely heinous can be that as well, if you use different types of weapons. But it's my understanding that at least one of the special circumstances that would make him death eligible potentially, or for a mandatory life sentence, was just that there were two victims in the case.
And so it's, you know, being a first degree murder, special circumstances would put him in jail for the rest of his life with no possibility of getting out. And if it's something lesser, and we're going to talk maybe about different lesser charges, what, you know, that he could see the light of day. And so I'm going to go over that in a minute. But My understanding is that the last time that Reiner was in court, he was shackled and he was wearing a suicide vest. What do you make of that? Is there something that you can draw from that, you can conclude from that?
Sure. I mean, that's usually controlled by the jail or the sheriff's department. And I am sure that they had reason to believe that he was a potential danger to himself based on the nature of the case, based on probably some mental health issues that he had. So I think they're just taking precautions in order to ensure nothing happens to him.
Okay. Let's talk about the issue of competency to stand trial, which is different from the insanity defense. Can you tell our listeners what it means to be competent to stand trial and how does that get assessed?
You have to know what the proceedings mean to work with your lawyer. You have to basically understand what is happening to you. And if a lawyer has a bona fide doubt that somebody's competent, then they have to raise it. There are psychiatrists, psychologists involved, and somebody cannot be tried until they are competent, until they're restored to competency.
And I would imagine that is not to show that the defendant is incompetent. That's a pretty high burden. I mean, if someone doesn't know what's going on, you know, that's going to be really hard to prove, right?
It can be, but it's case specific. I mean, there are situations, and again, you know, I've seen it happen where individuals were found not to be competent for different types of mental health issues. So you got to understand, you know, there are people out there who get involved in criminal acts who have significant mental health issues, and some of them to the extent where, yeah, they don't know what's going on or they can't assist their defense. So in those situations, you know, this is what the court has to do.
And in the event that somebody is not competent to stand trial, what is the procedure going forward?
You have to, first of all, have a doctor who determines that they're not competent. Then you have to have a competency hearing. Sometimes the state will disagree with the finding, and they will determine that, no, you know, we're going to get our own doctor, and we're going to say that he is competent, and then the judge has to make the decision.
And if the person is incompetent at that time, when is there a trial, or is there ever a point in time where there's never going to be a trial because he's never going to be competent?
Well, from time to time, what will happen is they will have hearings to determine if their competency has been restored. So oftentimes what will happen, let's say somebody is suffering from schizophrenia, you know, there will be situations, and I'm working on a case like this now, where an individual was off their medication, and when they were off their medication, you know, something happened. It wasn't a murder, but once they were placed in custody and put on their medication, then they were restored to competency. So oftentimes the restoration to competency will be with medication. And actually there's a finding that they at least make in Illinois competent with medication. So that's one of the issues that really sort of, you know, goes to the heart of this oftentimes when individuals aren't properly medicated, you know, and they're schizophrenic or have other issues that can cause psychotic episodes.
Damon, the insanity defense has been talked about. Can you tell our listeners what it means to lodge an insanity defense and what has to be proven?
So in California, where this case is going to be pending, it's the McNaughton test. And essentially, that's from an old case, you have to establish that you did not know the difference between right or wrong. You could not comprehend what you were doing, and that was as a result of a mental health issue, a mental defect, a mental disease. So, you know, the burden is on the defendant to establish that. And it's a high burden, obviously, to get to that point where a jury or a judge is going to say, look, they didn't know what they were doing. Now, in my experience, and again, in cases I've had, when you have an actual legitimate underlying diagnosis, and usually it's schizophrenia or something like that, you know, that's the first step towards being able to lodge that defense. And sometimes they're very valid defenses. I'm not saying that's the case here by any means, but, you know, that's what you have to show. I didn't know what I was doing. I couldn't appreciate the criminality of my conduct. So I'm therefore not responsible for it.
But being schizophrenic or having that diagnosis is alone not enough. You still have to prove that you knew you didn't know what you were doing was right or wrong.
Absolutely. That's not a standalone defense. I have this mental health issue, so therefore I'm not responsible. And it really comes down to experts, right? Expert witnesses, psychiatrists, in the case, those are the witnesses who will look at somebody, look at the facts of the case, look at the reports, do interviews, and say, in their opinion, based on a reasonable degree of psychiatric certainty, I do not believe this individual knew the difference between right or wrong or could appreciate the consequences of their actions. And then, you know, the other side oftentimes will get a rebuttal expert to say, no, that's not what it was. He was sick. He had these issues, but he certainly could have understood the difference. And it's a battle of the experts.
So, you know, in this case, we don't know much at all. But what I have seen on the internet is that there were some videos of him. He had gone to a hotel after the murders occurred, went to a hotel. It looked like he probably changed clothes, washed up, and he went into a store to buy something to drink. Now, how does that play into it? If a person knows that he did something wrong, and he can calmly wash the blood off of him and go pay for a drink in a store, how does that play on an insanity defense?
So here's how it plays, and I had this very same issue. The state will argue that if somebody can change their shirt, they're not insane. I don't agree with that, and from my research and from the cases I've handled, you know, psychosis is not that easy. And I had an expert who explained it as you have to look at the entire movie. You can't just look at a scene. And the way I explained it in my closing argument was like, it was like watching The Wizard of Oz. In the first 20 minutes, it's black and white. And then all of a sudden, you're in Oz. And it's all these colors and all this sort of craziness happening. And that's oftentimes what a psychotic episode is. It doesn't mean you can't drive a car. It doesn't mean you can't go into a 7-Eleven and buy something to drink. The issue is, at the time the crime occurred, you know, do you reach that standard? Were you in a psychotic episode? And people can do a lot of things other than commit crimes while they are suffering from those types of issues. So it's very complicated. It's complicated stuff.
Yeah. And, you know, and the other fact that we are hearing is that the night before, there was a party at Conan O'Brien's house, and Nick Reiner was acting odd. He was asking strange questions of some of the famous guests, and there was an argument that ensued. How does that play into a defense of insanity, do you think?
That can go both ways, right? I mean, you may have the defense saying, look, he was not acting himself. He was not acting normally. And the other thing is, I understand that he was on a new medication, which opens up a whole other, you know, world for a defense attorney. But, you know, a defense attorney might say, look, he was showing signs of this psychotic episode the night before. The state might argue, look, he got into an argument with his parents. This was motive. So, and that's the clash between the sides, right? You know, you look at facts, and as a defense lawyer, you argue one way. As a prosecutor, you argue another. But that will certainly be something that plays out if this case goes to trial.
Now, Alan Jackson is a very well-known lawyer. He represented Karen Reed and some other high-profile defendants. What do you know about him? Do you know anything about him? And do you kind of get a sense on where he's going to go with this, just from maybe what the press conferences he's given?
Yeah, no, I do know him, and he's a good lawyer. He's a very good lawyer. And, you know, one of the issues is, you know, the facts sometimes are what they are. Like in the Karen Reed case, you know, it was a whodunit, and he was able to make those arguments. If identity is not an issue in this case, in other words, if, you know, they can establish it was Nick Reiner, which it looks like they can, then he's limited to either a self-defense, which he's not going to lodge because that doesn't probably make any sense, or some type of mental health disease defense, or potentially maybe an involuntary intoxication. Maybe the medication he was on had a crazy adverse effect that he was not used to because he was recently diagnosed. But those are the types of defenses that are available to you in these types of situations. And from what I've seen of him in the cases he's tried and the way he comports himself, you know, he's the real deal. He's a very, very good attorney. And, you know, I'm sure he's going to do everything he can to get the best outcome, whatever that may be.
And let's just talk quickly about how that medicine issue, drug addiction, and mental illness can work. So maybe not an absolute defense for insanity, but could it bring the case down to more of a second degree charge as opposed to a first degree? And how would that work, and how would that argument go?
Sure. I mean, there have been situations where people have taken medications and have had adverse effects that have caused them to have psychotic episodes. That's happened. When you're talking about second-degree murder, though, you know, what you're really talking about is, was there a situation where they got into a fight and he was so overwhelmed with passion that he could not control himself and he did not have a cooling-off period? Those are really second-degree murder issues. When you get into the issue of, you know, an adverse effect from a pill that, you know, sort of caused a psychotic episode, you know, then you're still going down sort of the insanity defense route to an extent. There may be an involuntary intoxication defense, something where, you know, he took this medication, you know, he had never acted like this before, and then all of a sudden his, you know, his behavior changed and he was not himself. And again, now you're talking about pharmaceutical experts, you're talking about a team of doctors who would have to get together to help forge that very difficult defense.
So, and finally, I want to talk about the death penalty. And my understanding is that California still has the death penalty on the table. And if these charges are successful, the death penalty, you know, could be levied against him. But there is a moratorium. I think for the last 20 years that California is not executing people. That doesn't mean that they can't seek the death penalty. My guess is that given the liberality of the Reiners and the family, that they do not want the death penalty for their sibling. How important is it that the family does not advocate for the death penalty? Do the prosecutors have to listen to the family? Will they listen to the family? What considerations will they give the siblings here?
Sure, I agree with you that they're probably not going to seek it in California. Also, I think that especially when you even have like the whiff of a mental health issue, they take that into account and they absolutely have to talk to the family. Now, at the end of the day, it's not solely up to the family, but they will take their consideration. They will take their thoughts into consideration for sure.
And if there is an insanity defense, what happens to a person who's been declared not guilty by reason of insanity?
Yeah, you don't just get let out the door. You are usually sent to like a hospital where you are treated, and then you have these hearings sometimes, you know, every 4 or 5 months, every 6 months, to determine if you are sort of restored to be able to go out into society. And that happens. You know, I've had clients who have been found not guilty by reason of insanity and eventually, sometimes years later, have been released. Something like this, it would probably take an extremely long period of time.
And again, the family, would he be better off in a mental health facility than a jail?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think anybody would be. It's still, you know, a very, I'm sure, difficult place to be, and your freedom is curtailed, but you're being treated by doctors for mental health conditions, and you're not, you know, in a cell nonstop and with other individuals who probably don't have those types of issues.
Got it. And, you know, just as a follow-up, we have a few minutes here. You represented Harvey Weinstein in case in New York. And what is going on with his various cases? I know there was an overturning of his case of the guilty, and I don't know if there has been a retrial. What is the status of everything with him?
Yeah, so I keep in touch with him. He went to trial again. He was acquitted of one count, convicted of another count, and then there was a hung jury on the third count. And now, for some reason, the state is looking to proceed on the count that was hung. And then his case in California is still pending. The appeal is still pending. So there's still a lot of work to be done on that case. But he was convicted of one count on the retrial, acquitted of one. And then again, one was hung, and New York wants to try him a third time. And then he's confident about the California appeal. I mean, you know, I think that I know the issues in that case. That was a case Alan Jackson was on. There were a number of issues in that case that may very well lead to a new trial there. So the saga continues.
Is there a possibility that he could be out of prison before he dies?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, there is. And he's certainly holding out for that and staying strong and keeping that belief and fighting as much as he can. But that's certainly a possibility.
So my final question to you, Damon, is New Year's resolutions. Do you make them? And if so, what are they?
Oh, wow. Yeah, I make them. This year, it's to go to the Bears Super Bowl. but as the game is going on right now, I don't know if that's going to happen. You know, just work harder, spend more time with my family, you know, and try to be calmer. I think it's my resolution.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to work for you, Damon. I think you're in a permanent state of agitation.
Well, you know, it's what are you going to do? It's the life I've chosen.
That's right. That's absolutely right. And what do you have on your plate right now? What kind of cases are you working on?
I've got a trial coming up January 20th in federal court that I've been getting ready on. It's an extortion trial. And then a busy year. We've got a number of cases going to trial. I have a few murder trials that are going to be tried, other federal cases, a couple cases out of state. So it's going to be a busy year.
Well, good for you and good luck. And can you tell people again how to contact you, give them your spelling, and give them your phone number as well?
Sure. It's just at CheronisLaw, CHERONISLAW.com, and my office number, 312-663-4644. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, too. And thank you for your time.